Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill is similar to the last one in the sense that last legislative session, the legislature passed a significant change in the law in this area. House Bill 2395 deals with the hearsay exception identified in the Rules of Evidence as Rule 803-18AB, which allows the out-of-court statements of a child victim, a victim of sexual abuse, under 10 years of age to be admitted in court contrary to the hearsay rule, or I guess you might say as an additional exception to the hearsay rule. Of course, all of the exceptions to the hearsay rule are rooted on some theoretical or practical reason why those statements made out of court bear some particular reliability, such as statements to a physician, where the concept is you don't lie to your doctor that's going to treat you. And likewise, the law requires certain indicia of reliability of the statements of a child made out of court. And those, in fact, are built right into the law that the legislature passed last time. The limitation of the law that we would like this session to address is that it only applies in criminal proceedings or juvenile court proceedings. And by the way, I submitted some written testimony where I said it doesn't apply in juvenile proceedings, and that's wrong. It does apply currently in juvenile proceedings. The intent of this bill is to extend it to other proceedings. And most significantly, as I see it, would be domestic relations proceedings. One of the things that we heard over and over again from parents of abused children while we were on the task force was, why does my child have to testify? I mean, he's told all these people, he's told Dr. So-and-so and Mrs. So-and-so from CSD, and he's told the police officer what has happened. Why does my little boy have to get up there on the stand in this austere courtroom and tell about it, too? This new law does provide some circumstances where the child need not testify at all if the child's otherwise unavailable and there is independent corroboration of the crime. The House Bill 2395 would extend that rule to other proceedings, and it's the task force belief that this would add one more area where the trauma to the child would be reduced.
All right, thank you. And
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, we're going to come back to questions if you've got some. Sure.
You specifically mentioned domestic relations cases.
Yeah. The two that I see are domestic relations and possibly in civil suits. I personally don't have a lot of experience with instances where children are called to testify in the civil suits. I do know that they're called to testify in the domestic relations proceedings.
All right. And then finally, if you can tell us about House Bill 2406 in an overview fashion.
Actually, in this instance, my written testimony is a little more in more detailed. Essentially, what this bill would do would be to extend the period of time for child victims or victims of child sexual abuse to be eligible for victims' compensation. It also has a second part which provides for state payment of forensic sexual assault examinations on minors. On the first area, I should tell you that before coming in here today, I had a conversation with Jerry Christensen of the Crime Victims Compensation Section, and she believes, and I think she's correct, that it may be that the first part of this, that is extending the time during which a child may be eligible for crime victims compensation, that may be accomplished through administrative rule, and that's something that the Department of Justice is pursuing at this time. So it may, in fact, be we do not need that portion of the legislation if it can be accomplished through administrative rule. As it is now, the Department of Justice must have the claim filed within 6 months, and then for good cause can extend it for an additional 6 months. And the administrative rule that's been proposed would make it open-ended, which is the same thing we're, in essence, asking the legislature to do. So the task force strongly supports this. We find a lot of victims who are very much in need of the kind of counseling and other help that can be made available to them through the resources of crime victims compensation. The second area that the bill covers is payment for forensics examinations. the legislature heard, I think, 4 years or perhaps 6 years ago, a lot of instances where the victims or the victims' families were ended up paying these bills in a lot of counties. I don't think that happened in mine, but I can't say that it didn't happen in other counties. So the legislature enacted a law which requires the investigating agency to pay for it. And now the experience that is being brought up to me, though I've not received that information firsthand, but that some agencies are now reluctant to have those exams done because of the cost. We're asking for the legislature for help in funding this important part of a thorough child abuse examination. I might add, too, that these types of examinations are not that simple. It is something that requires a certain amount of expertise. So in providing the funding, it may be that the legislature will also want to set some criteria for the people that do these examinations. That's essentially the task force view on House Bill 2406. I hope you'll support it.
Thank you. I think what we might do now is, Representative Courtney, I know you've got a lot on your schedule, so I'll ask members of the committee right now if they have questions for Representative Courtney on any of the work of the task force, in addition to any of the specific bills, and then once we're finished with that, we'll go back to the first bill and start with questions on for Mr. Collins. So, any questions for Representative Courtney before we...
There, just for your information, there's another bill in on this compensation thing. It shows you some of the cracks involved in the system. I had a call from a woman who alleged to me that she had been raped by a man who now is at Oregon State Penitentiary, and her daughter at 6 or 5 years of age had been forced to watch it, had seen it. And she was going through a great deal of trauma, but the counseling of the daughter, the cost of it was not eligible under our crime victims compensation. She was a secondary victim, and there is a bill in, too, to try to deal with that kind of crisis situation. It's somewhat related to this issue in the sense it was an act of sexual aggression. It affected a child, and yet the compensation system would not allow her, the mother, to be compensated or pay for the counseling for the little girl because the girl herself wasn't actually the one who was being raped, although she was about 5 or 6 years old. I don't know where that bill is going to go, Chair Clark, but it's also in the House.
Right. Other questions, Representative Courtney? I do have one. Representative Mason.
Well, Representative Courtney, you bring us some very, very hard bills. These are about as tough as they come. But
right.
And because they're tough bills, I think some tough questions need to be asked. And the toughest question I want you to answer is on the statute of limitations here.
Mm-hmm.
This is, to use the wonderful legal phrase, a 23-year statute of limitations on a non-capital crime is probably unprecedented in the criminal law, and I think I'm correct there. All the other ones run, I said non-capital, but
right.
All the other ones run 7 years and a few federals at 10. So you've basically tripled the statute of limitations. So you're going, I'm laying out, you're going contrary to a you know, 300-400 years of tradition here. I just want to put this, you're tripling the statute of limitations. That's a tremendous move, and I just want to know what thinking that the committee did and you did vis-a-vis that statute of limitations, which for time immemorial has traditionally been 5 or 7 years for non-capital crimes.
Well, we didn't analyze it the way you've analyzed it. I hope you'll allow me to say that, Chair Clark, Representative Mason, the history of statute of limitations and all that was. We didn't get into all that. I think it's awful hard to convey to you what it's like to be in this task force. I think what finally came to us after days and days and weeks and months is that at this time in our society, it probably won't be true by the end of this century, given the visibility we're now giving this issue and the fact that we're sort of coming out on the issue. We're starting to talk about it. We're starting to try to deal with it. There will be much more of a freedom on the part of individuals, children and relatives, to deal with it and to talk about it and to notice those signs where heretofore we didn't realize what those signs were, so that the child will talk about it, the minor will talk about it so much earlier, and you wouldn't need this at all, Representative Mason, to be very frank with you. But we're not there yet, is a, in terms of a society or is a race, human race, on this particular part, shall we say, inhuman conduct, unnatural conduct. And that is why we were not as offended as apparently you are by the nature of your question to extending the statute of limitation in such a horrendous way. But I would be the first to admit to you that maybe in the years to come, where we deal with this subject much more openly and much more forthright, and we know much more about it. I thought I said to this committee last week that we haven't even looked at this issue until the last 5 to 8 years in terms of analyzing why people even do this kind of stuff. Even the psychiatrists and the sex therapists are admitting to us now that they really don't know as much as they pretend to know about what's going on in the human animal when you do these things. And the hiddenness and the mystery and the suppression involved in this, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. District Attorney, is such that we feel we must allow this kind of extended time limit to let individuals finally come forward and talk about it. You do recall the example of many seniors coming before us public hearings and crying about saying this is the first time in their life they felt they could even talk about what was done to them as children. The woman comes into my office today and told me this is the first time, and I don't know whether she's telling the truth or not, that she said this is the deacon of my church, Peter. She had never talked about that before. She claims I'm the first person in my office today she talked to about. Now, so maybe this to you is an overreaction, and I know what you're saying, Representative Mason, but I want you to also understand the context of sitting on this task force and hearing hours and hours of this kind of testimony and trying to deal with it. So I think that's the reason, Representative Mason, that we chose to go this way.
Representative Mason? Oh. Representative Sanceri.
Representative Courtney, on 2395, just a question. I am certainly interested in protecting the children at every cost and even erring on the side of the children and their protection. But I can't think of anything that would be worse than to be falsely accused
Absolutely.
Of such an outrageous thing. And do you see any danger in extending hearsay ability here to false accusation, the angry divorcee? Things are coming to my mind that could create some real problems.
There's no question that this is a very risky thing we're doing, because this is one of those areas that once you're accused, you're guilty. I don't care what our system says about being innocent until proven guilty. I think we can say there are certain areas in our society that you hope you never get accused of this, because the lords and the gods and the angels, you name it, whoever you worship in your life, can come down and do whatever they want, and people aren't going to believe it. There's no question that I cannot tell you there won't be abuse under this bill if it becomes law. Hearsay always leaves that window and that door open. I'm not going to deny that. And in fact, I should tell you, a pillar of this community called me aside one day to talk about what he and his son and his two grandchildren have been through for 10 years because the son's wife, ex-wife, had decided to use the children in this very way, and it's been horrible, and what he's been subject to, and I believe it. So I can't tell you as I sit here today that this is a guaranteed approach that the abuses won't have, and I can't tell you that. And it is risky, and there are dangers involved. So I have to say, yes, Representative Suri, that there's some dangers here. It could be abused and misused, and I don't know what else to say than that.
Can I respond to that in part, Mr. Chairman and Representative Sanceri?
Please.
I think the thing to keep in mind is that House Bill 2395 doesn't change anything in a criminal law case. It does nothing. I think Mr. Gardner from Deschutes County may offer some additional suggestions to you today, later on, that may do that. But 2395 doesn't change anything in a criminal case or a juvenile case. It only extends the statute or the exception to the hearsay rule into other cases or all other cases, which of course would include domestic relations cases. And then keep in mind, too, that even for the out-of-court statement to be admissible, there must be a showing of certain indicia of reliability. And one of them, and I'm sort of glancing through the law here to find it, and I'm not pinpointing it real quickly, but I know that one of them is any motive that the person testifying might have to falsely represent what the child said. It's not exactly those words, but, for example, if mom in a domestic relations case is relating what the child said to mom,
the fact that mom may have something to gain in that domestic relations case, in the child custody issue or divorce issue, that will mitigate against or will work against that statement being admissible in the first place. So I guess my point is it doesn't change anything in the criminal law cases, and further, there are a lot of safeguards built into it in those indicia of reliability.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Would you still agree, though, with Representative Courtney and my thoughts, too, that there is a danger here with this, that someone could be falsely accused, and whether or not the court would deal with that, once that's out, the damage is really done to the person falsely. That possibility exists. Is that not true?
That possibility exists, yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bellman, Representative Mannix.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just bursting to respond to Representative Mason's comments, but I'll save that for work session. Right. I realize that would be more appropriate.
Thank you. Representative Mannix.
I think it's important to say that a person can be falsely accused regardless of what you do with the hearsay exception in a civil or criminal proceeding. The false accusation can be made right now, regardless of what we do with this bill. The concern may be how that accusation is used in a proceeding, and we need to address that. But I think it's important to clear the air to say that anybody can make a false accusation, and we aren't doing anything here to make it easier or harder to make the accusation. We will have to deal with the question as to how it is dealt with in terms of an exclamation or a report in a court proceeding. But that's something further down the line after the accusation has already been made. The protection will be the corroboration factor and the indicia of reliability that are going to be required here. And I think we'll need to get into that when we delve into the bill. Thank you. That's more of a comment than a question.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. Representative Courtney, I do have a question for you. There are other bills that the task force has come forward with that are not in front of us today, some of which will be in front of us and some of which will be in front of other committees. I'm curious as to whether any of those bills have funding components and how you expect to fare on the funding battles. And can you explain what those funding components are? It seems to me I remembered that you and the co-chair of Ways and Means, Representative Van Vliet, were talking one day and you made some comment about just give me whatever it was, $500,000 for my kids or something. Which bills were those, and what do you expect to happen to those?
Well, some of the bills have definite referrals. What do I expect? It's anybody's guess. I have not entered into a meaningful dialogue with the co-chair or the speaker or the majority leader, or even the chair of this committee. So I don't know what we can expect in terms of ways and means on this particular issue, to be very frank with you. So I don't know how else to answer your question. I don't have any signal at this time that, as important as I think this issue is and as important as I think it is the most, as this committee will think. I think you, regardless of the number of bills you send out or not, I think you'll send out some, at least, Chair Clark. I just don't know what kind of funding is going to be there.
Okay. Representative Courtney, I want to thank you for your leadership on this issue. Thank you for your hard work on the task force and for bringing these bills to us today. You are, of course, invited to stay. You're invited to sit on the committee if you would like and ask questions or make comments. When we begin to move these bills out, we'll be asking you to carry some, if not all of them. I just want to say we really appreciate your leadership on the issue.
So you're not going to, today, Mr. Chair Clark, you don't have a work session today on these bills, is that right?
We have a possible work session on all of them. I don't know exactly what we'll get through. I know the committee's got some questions on them. So we will be sure to keep you apprised as we go along.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Courtney. We will move back into public hearing on House Bill 2412. Ask Mr. Collins to stay up because I think there were some more questions of you. And the questioner has disappeared. Representative Mannix had some questions. Okay, further questions on House Bill 2412 by the members of the committee? All right, I do have a question, Mr. Collins. Can you tell us about other expedite requirements that are on the courts right now? It seems to me that, as I recall reading through the rules of civil procedure, rules of criminal procedure here and there, there are other places where the legislature has told the court this one gets top priority. And I'm wondering how many of those are courts looking at and how they sort those out.
I only think there's one other. I might be overlooking one, but there's only one that I know of, and that's where the defendant, on no matter what the charge, is in custody. then they must be given priority.
Okay. I thought I recalled some of the proceedings in civil cases. The civil procedure rules had some high priority designations in them somewhere, but perhaps not.
I think there's something that gives criminal cases generally a priority over civil, but not. I'm not aware of any that specifically exist in the civil field, but I confess to not being much of an expert on civil cases.
Right, and this bill is across the board, civil and criminal.
Yes.
Any case where a child is a witness.
Yes.
Right. Not just sex abuse cases, not just criminal cases, but any case where a child is a witness.
Yes.
Which would include all the Don Morell cases.
It would.
Theoretically. Okay. Is there... is that deliberate? To include all the Don Morell cases as well.
Yes. I don't know that we thought, well, we need to include Don Morell cases, but our focus was upon the child and reducing the delay for a child witness, period. We didn't think of it in terms of specific areas, simply the fact that there would be a child who would be a witness.
My concern, if I can just follow Rep. Mason before I call on you, I guess my concern is if what we're getting at is the specific cases where sex abuse is an allegation, criminal or Don Morell, that makes an awful lot of sense to me. I'm a little bit concerned about telling the presiding judge of the Multnomah County Circuit Court that all Don Morell cases where a child under 18 might be called to testify shall take priority. There are a lot of cases. Some of them where the only reason the child is going to be called to testify is, you know, I suppose when dad bought his pickup truck or some such thing, have really nothing to do with the corpus of the bills that you're bringing to us today. And I'm wondering whether what your reaction would be if we tried to tailor this bill down a little bit to cases where there's an allegation of sexual abuse in some way, shape, or form.
Mr. Chairman, I would have no objection to that. I think our interest was in protecting child witnesses no matter what type of proceeding they testify in, but it does seem to me that the greatest area of difficulty for the children will be the sexual abuse type cases. So given if the committee wants to pare it down, that would be the way to do it.
And don't get me wrong. I mean, I think the way we handle family law in this society is crazy in terms of an adversarial system and pulling a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old, whatever it is, in front of a judge on any of those issues. But nonetheless, we have to be a little bit sensitive to what we're doing to the courts out there. And there are an awful lot of Don Morell cases where kids are called to testify on issues other than sexual abuse, and I just don't know that the courts would be able to respond meaningfully to this charge if we left it the way the Representative Mason.
Yes, my comment. I heard a CLE presentation, and for non-lawyers, you don't have to get your ticket punched for CLEs, but I heard a marvelous CLE presentation by Judge Welch, Multnomah County Circuit Court judge who specializes in domestic relations. And I thought a very perceptive part of her testimony was that one should go to the greatest extent possible to avoid having children testify at Don Morell hearings. It had been her experience. It had been her experience that bringing children in to testify as to custody and that type of thing, and I'm just relating this, that to bring children in to testify as to custody and other things, it was her experience that was psychologically devastating to the child later, because then the children, especially in custody, you know, which way do you want to go, son, that type of thing, that asking that child that question either in private or in the open court was psychologically devastating because the child later would blame himself or herself for the dissolution of the marriage. And I just wanted to interject that I thought that she was being very, very perceptive. And if I just might throw this out, I think this situation is much more complex than meets the eye. And the psychology that goes on here is a bit subtle. I'm very uncomfortable with us getting involved. Just me up front, I'm very uncomfortable with us getting involved in domestic relations law, and I agree with the chairman 100%. The adversarial situation in domestic relations, for those of us who have practiced there, is the worst way in the world to end marriages. I mean, that's my... No.
Representative Bell, I appreciate those comments.
I just have a comment, and maybe you could enlighten us on this, but It's my perception that children in general, whether it's on any case, are it's very hard on them to make decisions that are going to affect somebody else's life.
True.
It's very hard for them to point the finger at someone else, unless it's a brother or sister, and actually have to account for that. They are not prepared to account within themselves. And so what we see at a very dramatic level in a marriage, it also occurs, I believe, in a small case, whether it's an accident report or something like that, where they have to be the one to witness and testify that somebody did wrong. So I think maybe we do need to look at the whole spectrum of cases.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Mannix.
A couple of questions. One is, last session, my recollection was, we had legislation allowing the videotaping of testimony of children in sex abuse cases. Is that right?
It's a little, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, a little bit more restrictive than that. You have to have a showing by a psychologist, I believe, that the child would be traumatized by testimony. I can tell you as
the concern was there was because we're dealing with the balancing and we're dealing with the confrontation clause of
right.
the Constitution. Okay.
And I think the circumstances under which it's used in a criminal case especially are rather limited. I know in my county, for example, since that law took effect, we have not used it.
Separate question has to do with my recollection that there are several statutes that tell the courts now to give precedence to certain kinds of matters. Termination of parental rights comes to mind. When circuit courts used to handle workers' compensation, they were told to give that precedence. And isn't there a shopping list of precedential statutes out there, and the courts have to constantly decide how to juggle five or six statutes telling them to give all of these things preference?
We went through that a minute ago when you were out, Representative Mannix, and Mr. Collins, why don't you repeat your answer, because I was surprised at his answer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, it sounds like you could answer the question better than I can, at least in part. But I can say this, in my experience in the criminal cases, there's only one other statute that requires a priority, and that has to do with the defendant who's in custody, no matter what the charge.
There is a provision regarding proceedings as to termination of parental rights. There used to be a provision as to workers' compensation, but again, those are out of the circuit courts now.
Maybe what we'll do is, Representative Mannix, maybe what we'll do is ask counsel to do another run on that question so that we can
compare. Be helpful for us to try to address that in the context of this, because I happen to agree with the concept in certain limited kinds of cases of giving them precedence. And how do you feel about the chair's suggestion and Representative Mason's follow-up on that, that we try to limit those cases where the expedited action will be called for?
As I reflect upon it and listen to the discussion, I think, I mean, not only do the task force not object, it does sound like a good idea. I, quite frankly, I thought Mr. Representative Mason's point was particularly well taken, and I could even imagine, as I was sitting here, a situation where you had a domestic relations case. And I often find, in my limited experience with those, that the litigants are in a hurry to get those cases heard, and it wouldn't be beyond my imagination to foresee a situation where a litigant intentionally scheduled a child they wouldn't otherwise call in order to get priority. So that would certainly turn what this bill intends to do on its head by subjecting a child to something that they wouldn't otherwise be subjected to.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Mannix.
It also seems to me you could have a juvenile court proceeding where the victim is under 18 and the perpetrator is under 18, and it involves sex abuse of some nature, and we've just exempted juvenile court proceedings. So perhaps we should shift the focus to the nature of the causes belli, or whatever, the basic cause of the action.
It's cause of war, isn't it?
Is it causes belli?
Cause of war, I think.
We won't play with Latin on that one.
Good term for domestic. But
yeah. The major cause. The major emphasis of the case, not whether it's a juvenile proceeding or a domestic proceeding, I wouldn't care, except why is the child being called in to testify? What is the subject matter of the testimony? Maybe we could focus it in that direction.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Collins on House Bill 2412? Counsel.
John, I just have a couple of questions more in terms of the intent of the task force in this bill, basically to give us some direction. it has been raised to me, and I'm sure that this was not the intent of this, but I just want to clarify it, that this, in the way that it's written, would apply to a 17-year-old who was cited into court on a traffic offense. And I'm assuming it was not your intent to include that.
Yes, Ms. Robinson, I think you're correct on both counts. It does appear to include that, and that was not intended.
It would also, in that situation, occur to a 17-year-old who was a witness in a traffic case.
It would.
Okay.
And that was
and that's
not intended.
Your intent. Okay, good. Was there, this committee last session dealt with numerous bills dealing with, part of which the conversation had to do at what age, 18 and under, do you set certain things to happen? The committee went through this on numerous bills last session. Did the task force have a discussion about why they set this at 18 per se? And does the task force have a position on what, depending upon what it is that you want to do, what an appropriate age might be if it were to come down from 18?
To answer your question, I can't recall us discussing that except in terms of the 18 years being the juvenile adult distinction that we apply in a lot of areas in court. My own thought is that
know that offenders, especially the pedophile, does not quit. He's operated over many, many years, and we may not get a particular case reported to us until long into his history, and then even after that case, it's going to be a long time after. A recent case with Mr. DeFort, with the farm home case, he confessed to many of the crimes or victimization that took place prior to the statute of limitations, but would not admit to any of the cases that he was charged with, and we had to do a tremendous amount of work and with very difficult conditions to go ahead with that particular prosecution, and fortunately we're successful. And I've had other cases in the past also with Boy Scout leaders that confessed to 35 years worth of involvement, and being on the board of directors for the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence in Linton-Benton County. Same thing with victimization that's taken place over many, many years with the same perpetrator. And we need to be able to go beyond what we currently have access to us in the statute of limitations with children. These people don't quit, and they're continuing to go on.
Mr. Robson, let me just ask an outrageous question. Why do we have statutes of limitations at all? Why don't we just, and I don't want to go to the up, just let me flop way over here for a minute and say, why don't we just do away with them all in all crimes? No, I'm serious. I mean, I want to get the dialogue going a little bit from standpoint of what purpose do they serve, what value or good do they serve, and what are we giving up in exchange for allowing us to get at some of these offenders? What are we giving up in that process?
In this particular case, I don't think we're giving up anything. Unless I'm answering your question wrongly. I believe statute of limitations should run almost forever in these types of cases just because of the uniqueness of the sexual exploitation of children and what it encompasses and what happens to the victimization and the withholding of being able to deal with those issues at all. As to other crimes, I think it's probably more of an area of logistics in dealing with the particular cases is why statute of limitations are put on them. It'd be almost unwieldy to be able to take care of cases that are 15 and 20 years old. But when you're dealing with an individual...
Because of why? Why?
To take care of cases that you may get presented to you after some period of time and be extremely difficult to prepare.
Simply because of the memory of witnesses, I suppose.
That and evidence.
All right, Representative Maddox.
Well, I think he addressed the question that had to do with the whole concept of why would we want to open it up, and at some separate stage of these proceedings, I may raise the issue of generally opening it up on as to crimes against persons.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Gardner, would you come up and let's do a tag team here?
Let me address that just real quickly. One of the things that we know is that the general criminal personality commits this crime in what's known as the sociopathic age period, which begins approximately 12, 13 years old and goes on until around 35. That frequently speaks very poorly of our strategies for dealing with those criminals, because we typically slap them on the wrist, hit them with a big jail term about the time they're going to quit committing crimes. However, with the person who commits sexual offenses, there is no such pattern. They tend to frequently begin as juveniles and end in their later years. We've seen offenders who abuse their daughters, as far as we know, quit abusing for 35 years until their daughters bring granddaughters back into the home. So we really do have a criminal type who's fixated in a way on a certain criminal behavior that doesn't erode away with years. And then the final comment is, as a practical matter, it's very unlikely that law enforcement has the resources to go back and start investigating 20-year-old crimes. And the reality is the way we're going to get into those crimes is when that Cub Scout or that Boy Scout or that granddaughter comes forward, and in the course of her coming forward in that investigation with a current offense, we start to unravel a history of offenses that goes back into fairly remote time. Those would be the cases that this would apply to.
And you, of course, still would have to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that all of this occurred.
Certainly.
And so the defendant at that point is going to have the benefit, I suppose, in terms of fairness, of being able to ask the jury to consider how well does this person really remember what happened 22 years ago. All I'm trying to do is,
right,
is explore the ramifications here and make sure that...
That and as well, they're going to raise the issue of why was there a delay in reporting, and if we're not prepared to answer that as prosecutors of these types of cases, we shouldn't be prosecuting them, frankly. So.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mason, did you have some questions from your earlier comments?
Just a comment, ask the witness and further comment on the function of the statute of limitations. I haven't heard it placed in a context yet, in the sense that the statute of limitations has always served a certain societal purpose in clearing the system out, and we just can't handle things that old.
Right.
That's been, and I think that's. I hate to sound so traditional here today. I am a Democrat, but it's.
If I may draw
but
your
you wear
attention,
cufflinks, so I don't know.
There is an excellent publication by the Department of Justice that you can get for free that does a comparative analysis of child abuse laws in all the states. I'm not aware of what the child abuse laws in all the states provide for as the statute of limitations. I am aware, because my family's from there, that Kentucky has no statute of limitations, and I had mentioned that previously. I don't think you were here. So there is a different way and approach in different states on how to view that. I can hopefully provide you with a copy of that. I think it addresses statute of limitations, and you could look to see how the different states address it, but I don't think it is as fixed a 5 to 7 year statute of limitations as you've suggested.
I'm going to ask counsel and Mr. Gardner to give us a little information on what other states do with the statute of limitations.
Okay. I'll be glad to.
Representative Mason.
I hate to get off the esoteric, but we might take a look also, and just for what it's worth, see what Canada does also. It's actually
That isn't the publication I'm aware of, but okay. I'm sure your counsel could find that information.
Right.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Mannix.
I would be happy to see what Oregon did before about 1972.
Before 1970?
Yeah, that's about when there was a change in tone for a while in our criminal code.
It wasn't just Oregon, Representative Mannix. All right, thank you very much. Mr. Drews.
Steaming 60s.
Once again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Drews, Acting Assistant Administrator for Child Protective Services of Children's Services Division. We would strongly encourage you to pass this bill. You have written testimony from me. I would like to make two comments. I, like Representative Bell, am bursting to respond to Representative Mason. The issue for me is that the crime that this bill is, at least in its present draft, aimed at is one that the only comparable crime I can think of is rape. In terms of the victim's having to deal with shame, guilt, fear, a whole raft of emotions that frequently lead to the victim not coming forward and saying anything. Sometimes, as people have testified already, for years and years. The other issue that I would ask you to consider, Mr. Gardner has also talked about, which is that studies have documented that pedophiles have multiple victims. And just because somebody comes forward 20 years after the fact and gives you information about somebody, you can't assume that there aren't other children at risk who don't need protection. In fact, you can almost assume that there probably are other children at risk from that same person. So I'd ask you to consider that in your deliberations. In response to the issue raised by Representative Mannix about an alternative, which would be to trigger the statute of limitations at age 18 for all crimes of abuse against children, I think the Children's Services Division would support that. My only concern would be whether or not, by making it that broad, we lessen the chances of passing what we've already got here. And I do believe that the crime of sexual abuse against children is important enough that I would ask that you weigh that in your considerations.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
Well, maybe we can do it with two bills. Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Drews?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parks.
I don't have any doubt, because it's happened in my own life, and I know that people hold this in, and at some time it's triggered many, many years later. And although I've defended a lot of criminals, I've never had the stomach to defend anybody in this kind of case, and so I got my own built-in prejudices. But I also know that what Courtney said was true. Your guilt, once you're accused, you're guilty till you're proven innocent. And I'm just horribly uncomfortable with getting somebody in the position, or you perhaps, 20 years down the road, proving the negative. And I don't know how you reconcile it. This is a real tough one for me. And so the thing I think I'd come down on, and that's where this is where we're finally getting to a question rather than a speech, is what is the social utility for society in prosecuting these crimes 20 years later?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parks, I'm in terms of social utility, my primary interest is not in prosecuting the pedophile. It's in making sure that other young children are protected. And as I stated, what we know about pedophiles is they don't stop. We're just beginning to develop treatment techniques, but we don't have anything that is considered state-of-the-art that works. And since we know that pedophiles have multiple victims and continue over long periods of time, as Mr. Gardner testified, my concern is if we are able to identify somebody, that we make sure that all children are being protected from that person. I would also like to respond to your speech by saying I share those concerns. I know what you mean. We all know what happens when an accusation like that is made. There are assumptions that everybody carries around then about the person who's been accused. I understand that. I'm here to advocate for children.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
What I gather from your testimony and earlier testimony is that if I've got a 35-year-old burglar, well, I've got a 35-year-old and we think we've got evidence now he committed burglary 10 years ago, what's the big deal because he committed burglary 10 years ago? I'm not so worried about a current threat necessarily. Whereas if I have a 35-year-old pedophile and I get information that 10 years ago or 15 years ago he committed crimes of sex abuse against children, we hear that sociologically this kind of person won't move away from that criminal activity, as many people do grow out of criminal activity who are criminals generally. So that person is much more of a current threat, and I have a social interest. And yes, if I have evidence of an older event and using that to get that person off the streets, is that the summation of what we're dealing with here?
Chairman Clark, Representative Mannix, yes, exactly.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mason.
Well, I think that the argument when presented that way is probably the most valid argument I've heard. But on the other hand, it opens up the whole question of protection of society. And the irony is that the sanctions that you will use don't protect society that well, because when we walk up to and look at some type of long-term control of these individuals, and I'm going into some of the possible legislation that will be considered under other times, when you've got long-term control of these individuals, we really come up very, very short. And one of the ironies is that once these people get into that mode of thinking, and we could have a wonderful discussion of the psychology of this, that's kind of there for life. And I know enough about this to be dangerous, as I say. But I mean, it's, of course, pedophilia is a variation of paraphilia and this whole business. And I refer you to Dr. John Money's books and studies on this, but it starts at a very, very, very early age. The best stuff I've read on this said that the psychology develops in these individuals anywhere between about 3 and 6, if not a little bit later. But these tendencies are engendered very, very early in people's lives and stay there pretty much forever. The implication being, if they stay there forever, what can you do to protect society forever? And that's the tragedy of it. You know, in a way, you're just, this is just minimal control. But sorry for my speech, but I mean, I can
appreciate that. All right, further questions for Mr. Drews? All right, thank you. Tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2411. Representative Baumann always has a wonderful sense of timing. We have lots of, committee, we have lots of work to do on these bills. These are not going to be easy bills. They are going to take some work. We will see them several times, I suspect, before we're done. Council tells me that we can expect to see these bills back next week, either Wednesday or Friday. We have a full plate on Friday of this week. We have a full plate on Monday of next week.
Other task force bills.
We have other sex crimes task force bills next Wednesday. So what we will try and do is revisit these bills either Wednesday or Friday and at least have some preliminary work sessions on them. I realize that some of the witnesses didn't get a chance to talk, and I apologize for that, but I think you would agree the questions were well worth taking the time for. So I thank the committee for your attention and hard work, and unless there's other business to come before us, we are adjourned.